it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And Tom Merritt is back. And this time he is not here as an internationally known podcaster, but as a fiction and nonfiction author. Tom, how are you doing today?
And then the last time I actually did this in person, we had a real pond.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We had, it was
down in Florida.
At the Disney Resort?
Yeah.
There were ducks and everything. Yeah. So yeah, that counted, right?
Yeah. But I don't need a pond. It's fine. It's fine. It's good.
You have a Diet Coke.
There we go. We'll chit-chat across the half-drunk Diet Coke.
There you go. Well, so you've been writing books for a while now. Let's see. You've got Events of a Different Nature, Lot Beta, Chronology of Tech History, United Moon Colonies, and now Citadel 32. You're just pumping them out here.
Yeah. I don't consider myself an author, but I am a writer because I write things. But an author I kind of reserve for people who are good at it. So I just like doing it. It's something that in the 90s, when I wrote my first ever book, it's something I really was seriously wanting to do, right? And I worked really hard on it and I polished the book and everything. And I just never got to the point where I did the things you need to do to be an author, which is, you know, try to get an agent and all of that sort of thing. I think I maybe sent the manuscript off once or twice. It certainly wasn't good enough for someone to buy. So when self-publishing came around, I took that as an opportunity to say, I enjoy doing this, even if I'm not motivated to spend the time or shift my time around to pursue it as a professional. Let me just see what I can do. And at the same time, there was National Novel Writing Month, which came along, which encourages you to write 50,000 words in a month. So I think it was in 2006 was the first time I completed National Novel Writing Month. I wrote a book, and that was United Moon Colonies. I got a friend of mine to edit it, and I published it on Lulu and just said, you know what? If people like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't.
So you actually answered my first seven questions here. How did you get into this? What about this self-publishing? So let's back up a little bit. What is the difference between self-publishing and I don't know what else to call it, but real publishing? What's the difference?
Yeah. So self-publishing used to be this horrible thing where you would like pay a vanity press to run a print run of your book because you weren't good enough to get published.
So you get like 1,000 of them in your garage and you got to figure out how to
sell
them.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And it's changed now to print on demand, which is companies that use technology to print paperback books. They're permabound books. They're nice. They're not the best bindings, but they're good. And as people order them, they print them and send them off, and then they cut a check to you for any that sold.
Some percentage of it.
So the way it works is you don't have to risk any money. You don't have to buy a print run. They just print them as they get ordered.
That's versus more environmentally sound,
I suppose, yeah. Whereas a real publisher, what they do is they guarantee a print run. They decide that your book is economically feasible, and they go out and they market it. And they have relationships with bookstores and they send people on authors tours. And honestly, the difference is you are much more likely to make money off your book if you publish it through a traditional publisher. It's just harder to get one to do
to
it.
Start with.
Whereas you are going to keep more of the money from your book if you self-publish, but it's harder to get it to sell.
So if you were to have a real publisher, they probably take a significantly larger percentage for a couple of reasons, one of which would be that they take a risk on me and my book's a complete loser, but they take a risk on you and it's a gain. They're gonna have to charge both of us, right? They've got to recover the losses they had on my book in order to get the gains for yours,
or vice versa. Yeah.
I just figured I'd throw you a bone there, Tom, since you're so self-deprecating.
Sure, sure.
But in that case, they also do things like advances, but getting over that threshold to get a publisher is very difficult, right?
Yeah, and the way that I think this is still the way it's done is you send off proposals, and there are lots of good resources to find the right way to write them to agents. Mm-hmm. And if the agent likes your book, then they will take it to publishers and try to get a publisher. And every author I've talked to gets rejected by multiple agents before they finally find the right one. And every agent gets rejected by multiple publishers before they finally find the right one, because it isn't a science. It's somebody has to think, you know what, I think I understand this author and this book and how to sell it, and then has to convince a publisher of the same thing.
So the agents work with the publishers. They're good with people. They're the middlemen, right?
Yeah. Instead of the reclusive authors that are hiding away in their garrets and their cellars.
So now, when you self-publish today, there's a whole nother avenue, right? There's the Lulu Press actually sending a physical book to someone, but ebooks.
Yeah. And
it's a whole nother Oprah.
Lulu,
right?
That I used as an example of print on demand, also does ebooks. Oh. And Amazon, with their Kindle Direct program, also offers something called CreateSpace, which can do print. So most of these self-publishing outlets will do both. In fact, it's kind of so simple, it'd be stupid not to do both. If you're going to make a print on demand book, you've already got all of the makings of an ebook.
Sure.
You might as well put that out there as well.
Sure. What goes into the file that actually gets created and uploaded? Because the formatting of it and how it's created. I mean, you don't just ship a PDF, certainly, or just a, well, you do?
Yeah, you can. In fact, okay. The Year in Tech History, which Scott Johnson illustrated and I wrote, was done monthly as Kindle singles. And each one of those Kindle singles I uploaded as a PDF, because the way his illustrations were laid out, it accepted that better than a Word document. But it's either a Word document or a PDF. The PDF just locks you into whatever design is in the PDF. It means right. You can't change it later, right? But if you're making that PDF out of a Word document, then you've got the Word document to tweak. And the Word document is just basically following a template that whatever publisher you're working with lays out as far as margins and gutters and things like that.
Oh, okay. So they give you a template to work with.
Yeah. They will all give you a template that you can either go the hard way and read their restrictions and do it yourself, or you can download a Word template. And if you have Microsoft Word, just throw it together that way. If you're using LibreOffice or something like that, though, you can still find the specs and make it yourself.
The reason I wanted to ask about that was because I've seen instances where illustrations cause a huge problem. I thought that my Kindle was broken because I read, What Would Happen If, by the XKCD guy.
Oh, Randall Monroe.
Randall Monroe's book. And I thought something was wrong with my Kindle because I would hit next page and nothing would happen for probably a millisecond longer than it should have, in my opinion. And the illustrations were really annoying because I couldn't read them, but they slowed the reading down. Whereas I looked at it on my iPad and it was fine. It worked really well there. And I wondered about formatting. That's what made me think that it matters.
There's all kinds of things that could cause that. It could be the original formatting that the book was submitted in. It could be the way Amazon reformats it when it makes it a Kindle, because all of these situations, you upload your source document and then they create multiple versions of it.
Oh, they do.
So there's EPUB, and then there's Kindle, and then there's a Nook format, the extension of which I can't remember right now. And there's Mobi, which is still in use for some. So depending on the service you're submitting it to, it's going to have to be converted into a different format.
Okay.
And even when you go to Amazon and directly upload it just for Kindle, let's say you don't care about any other format, you just want a Kindle version, it takes your source file and converts it into a Kindle file. They tell you the specs that'll make it the smoothest transition, but they're
still a transition.
Yeah.
So when you say you're doing all these other formats, are you using a quote-unquote publisher that is telling you how to do those?
Well, that's why I use something like Lulu, and I think CreateSpace does the same thing.
Okay.
Where I just upload my Word document, and it creates the multiple formats and submits them to the marketplaces.
Oh, okay. Now, can I ask what kind of a cut they take when they do that for you?
You can, and I can't remember.
You won't answer.
It's funny. With ebooks, it's a real generous... I want to say it's 70-30. It might even be more like 80-20, where you keep the majority of
right.
it. When you're talking about print,
there's a significant bigger cost,
and you also get even less if you're selling it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. So what Lulu does, let's say I sell a book, I charge $12 for it, and Lulu keeps $4 for the publication, which is, those are close to real numbers.
Because they're physically printing the book, putting it in a box and mailing it to somebody.
One of the reasons that I'm going to charge $12 instead of maybe $8 or $7 is because when they submit that book with its ISBN, the officially assigned number that allows it to be distributed to real bookstores, Amazon takes a big cut out of it. So it's the $4 for Lulu, and then it's $7 for Amazon.
Wait, why did Amazon take any of
Because Amazon's reselling it. They're saying...
Oh, more than Amazon is reselling it.
So the list price is $12.
Okay.
Lulu gets $4 of that.
Okay.
If Lulu sells it, I get the other $8. If Amazon sells it, Amazon gets a cut of the other $8.
I thought since you were going through Lulu for the physical book that Amazon was never involved in the process.
It doesn't have to be if I want everyone to buy it from Lulu.
Okay.
But if I want people to just stumble across it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, then you have to have it submitted there as well.
So Lulu is actually producing the book, but it's being sold through Amazon, so they take a giant chunk.
So when people ask me, which ebook version should I buy to help you out the most, which sometimes people do, I say, buy whichever one you want. It really doesn't matter that much. When people ask about print, I'm like, well, if you really want to help me, buy it directly from Lulu.com.
Oh, wow.
Because otherwise... the other reseller. It's just another middleman, right? Takes their cut out of it.
Sure. It sounds like they take a huge cut.
They do. They take a pretty big cut. It might not be like 7 out of 8, but it's pretty large.
That is significant. I had no idea it was that big.
That's what made me not so sympathetic to Amazon's letter when they sent me the letter saying, you need to help us fight the publishers who want to drive up prices. I'm like, you just want to keep all the money, Amazon. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're a business. But so are the publishers. Yeah.
Don't pretend, right?
It's not a moral cause.
You know, for a long time, the ebooks were the same price as the physical books.
From publishers, they were. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't understand how that could be.
Well,
I know bits do actually cost something. I know there is a cost, but there's an awful lot of stuff that isn't costing
money. Well, just remember, price is never based on the cost of production. Otherwise, lots of things would be so much cheaper.
Well, but I mean, I understand profit
margins.
Price
is what the market will bear.
Okay.
Right?
But at some point, that started to change.
I mean,
the e-books started to come down.
Soda. Soda costs virtually nothing to produce. But we pay 99 cents to buy a 2-liter bottle.
Buy a wedge salad in a fancy restaurant
like
for 90, $8.
Yeah, exactly. There's all kinds of things that we pay way above cost. So what the publishers were doing, in my opinion anyway, was saying, look, people are used to paying $8 for a book, right? That's just what they think
of. Let's see if they'll pay $8 and get more conveniently.
Let's start by charging $8 because that's the familiar price. And if, and then we can maybe give some discounts and see where the price is. Whereas people like myself were like, I'll take anything. And if charging $4 means it sells better, I'm going to charge $4. If charging 99 cents means it sells better, I'm going to charge 99 cents because I just want to get it in people's hands. So again, it's all economics, right? It's just, okay, I'm probably not worth as much because I'm not as well known. Whereas John Grisham
get a better cut. Too.
Robert Zelazny. I mean, people are willing to pay $12 for his books in print. Why wouldn't they an ebook? They want to read the words. It's not about the delivery mechanism.
Yeah, I don't know. It just really bothered me when I started doing the math on.
But were you ever paying for the paper, or were you paying for the story?
Well, not just the paper, but I understand paying for the story. But you mean what did I intend? What was my feeling? I was paying for it.
That's what the publishers were saying. People are paying for the story. It doesn't matter what the delivery is.
But then there wouldn't be people who said, "I need the hardback book." You know, I'm pointing for Tom's sake to the hardback books.
Well,
that's
where
different.
It does. I mean, there obviously is a difference because if you pay for a hardback book, you always paid more than for a paperback book,
right? Well, because it was a hardback book, right?
Well, and it is more costly to create a hardback book.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you read books yourself nowadays? Are you an ebook person or a physical
book
person?
Mostly audiobook.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just because I host Sword and Laser, which is a science fiction and fantasy book club, I have to read one book a month. I would like to read something else besides that. And audiobooks just are more convenient as far as fitting in reading time because I can be doing something else while I read it versus when you read print, whether it's ebook or a paper book, you have to look at it. You can't do much else.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm definitely more of an ebook person, but I'm not trying to cram in extra books a month.
I'm mostly audiobook, and then the remainder is ebook. For the most part, I will probably read 2 or 3 printed books a year.
I actually detest physical books now. When I pick them up, it's just like, ah, it's so heavy, and you know, trying to open if it's
well, not I have a third generation book. iPad, so it's about the same as a paperback
in terms of the weight.
Yeah, actually, that's, you know what? I don't even read my ebooks on the iPad anymore. I read them on the Nexus 9 because it's so much lighter.
Yeah,
I used to read them on the Nexus 7, which I think is actually the perfect reading experience.
Even better. Have you used like the Kindle Voyage or the Kindle Paperwhite?
You know, I had the early Kindles. I haven't used the Paperwhite. I don't like having to have a separate device just for that.
I do.
I don't
like
mind.
That
I don't mind the backlit
experience.
Screen.
Yeah. It's a book.
Interesting.
That's my book.
Yeah,
that isn't my other thing. Because I know when if I try to read on my iPad, I'm constantly saying, "Oh, what's going on Twitter?" You know, and I've lost track of what I was doing. But I can stay.
You have
notifications
on, don't you?
Well, maybe. But maybe I want to. You know,
because I in my head I was like, "Well, that never happens to me. I'm reading in full screen," and then I'm like, "Oh, because I have notifications."
Because you have notifications off
for things like Twitter, anyway.
I read on my iPad right up until the day I got a Kindle, and I just never looked back. It just no interest at all. Plus, it's easier to throw in things into my purse, and you know, I can have it with me so easily, but I don't always carry my iPad around.
Sure, sure. I actually read on my phone when I'm out and about. So a classic ebook reading situation for me will be out at the mall, walking around. Eileen wants to go into Sephora. So I sit on the bench.
You'd rather shoot yourself than walk in there.
No, I just got nothing to do. I have my 171 skin tone that I use, you know, very rarely, and I don't need to refill it. So there's nothing else for me to do in there. So I'll sit on the bench outside and I'll pull out my iPhone and the beauty of Kindle WhisperSync is I can pick up exactly where I left off on my Nexus 9 and start reading on my iPhone.
Right. Now, the only downside to WhisperSync, and I'm lucky, Steve wants his battery on his Kindle to last forever, so he never turns on Wi-Fi until he needs a book. He turns it on and then turns it off again. But we were reading The Martian at the same time, and I realized the only reason it worked was because he had Wi-Fi turned off. That would have been a mess if we'd been reading it together.
Oh, because you're on the same account?
Oh, yeah. We're on the same account. It would have been a nightmare. So back to writing books, and I mean this with all due respect, what made you think you could write a book?
Nothing. I still don't. I really, really honestly don't. I like writing books. I think I've gotten better at them, and other people have now told me like that wasn't bad. So I don't know. I might get there one day, but I think anybody can write a book. Like the act of sitting down and writing 50,000 words. I mean, they can be any words. Anybody could do it if they just really want to.
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Exactly. I mean, it is harder than you think.
Yeah.
In a way, every year during NaNoWriMo, I hit that wall. It's almost always the second week where I'm like, 1,600 words today. I just hate it. And then like third or fourth week, I'll be like 2,000 words. I'm still jamming.
Flying.
I'm just going. So not everybody wants to write a book. Not everybody can write a good book. But I think almost anybody could if they really push themselves.
The reason I asked the question was, I thought everybody thinks that they could write a book.
Yeah. I think
but
a lot
I said
of
that
do.
To Steve and he said, I don't. And it was fascinating to me because I thought, oh, by the way, I'm still figuring out that everybody's not just like me. It's a crazy thing to realize late in life. But
apparently the more you read, the more empathetic you get. So just
oh,
keep
that's
reading.
Right. There was an article about that, right? Makes you better people.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always thought I would write a book. And then as I was thinking about interviewing you and talking about this, I realized I have absolutely no ideas for books. So I think that might be an impediment.
Yeah, you do need an idea.
It slows you down.
I mean, it's not 100% required.
I could write a technical book, but
that's
a fiction
book. Yeah.
Right. But a fiction book, to me, I love to read. I love fiction, but I've never thought, wow, I could have done that.
Yeah, I always have ideas. My struggle with writing fiction is my ideas don't always translate into stories. And learning how to differentiate characters. So it's, you know, a lot of people who think they can write a book, myself included, sit down and like, I've got this wonderful world. So my very first book I ever wrote, it's the breakup of the United States into separate countries. And I have this detailed political reasons why it happens and the order of events and how the states separate. And then you sit down to write a story and you're like, so what happens? Because you don't, you can't write a novel I mean, you can't. You can. I guess you could write a novel that would just be like a fake history, and that would be an interesting thing. But when people say, I want to read a book, I want to read a story, they want to hear about the characters and their lives and their thoughts and their interactions.
There needs to be a beginning, a middle, and an end, not just a world. Right?
And so that was the hardest part, was like, how do I create characters that live in the worlds that I want to create? Because for me, it's easy to come up with like situations like, okay, there's a world in which people have a base on the moon and it gets cut off from the Earth because civilization falls apart on the Earth, and Earth gets thrown back technologically and into a new dark age. And how do the people survive on the moon? That's Citadel 32, right?
Okay.
I had that idea, and then it was like, okay, so who are
somebody
the people
might need to live there
on the moon, and why do we care about them, and how do we follow them? What do they do? What's the actual story? Like, it's great to say, okay, there's people on the moon doing that, and there's people on the ground doing that, but how do you tell a story out of that? What is the conflict? What is the growth of the characters? That's where actually writing stories becomes really difficult. And that's the part that I don't claim to have mastered.
It almost sounds like your ideas are game boards.
Yeah. Well, and you'll find, this is one thing I've had the luck to find out through doing Sword and Laser, lots of modern fantasy and science fiction authors became authors through running games.
Oh, really?
Building worlds for role-playing games.
Okay.
Patrick Rothfuss is a great example of that. He built his King Killer Chronicles world running role-playing games and then took that world and then wrote his amazing stories within it.
Interesting. Have you ever thought about creating a game?
Yeah. In fact, with Boiling Point, the breakup of the United States, at one point I tried to turn it into a role-playing game. Or I actually gave like material to someone as a role playing game. It didn't take off, but it could be made into one for
interesting.
Sure.
Interesting. Interesting. So what is your process beyond you force yourself to sit down and write 1,600 words in a single day? That is a lot of words.
Yeah. What I've stumbled into, and I don't know if this is good or bad or otherwise, but it's what I do all year long, from December through October. Not even joking, as I'm trying to fall asleep at night, will think about a story. And I'll pretty much live in that same story all year long. So it's like, I'm having a hard time falling asleep. During Citadel 32, I thought about like the citadels and what would happen if the population of the world declined and everybody concentrated into cities. And I would think about all these different story ideas. And then every once in a while, I'd go to my secret blog, subbrilliant.com/blog, and I would just bang a short story out. It's not even a short story. It's just like a study in something. Like, okay. I would take those ideas that I'd been boiling around in my head and I'd put them out. And then when November 1st comes, which is coming up very soon, I will sit down, and for National Novel Writing Month, you have to write 1,600 to 1,700 words a day to hit your 50,000 word character count. I will write out a story in that world that I've been percolating all year long.
We use the content that you actually put up on subbrilliant.com?
Yeah, and that's cheating in NaNoWriMo. I didn't used to do that. I was like, not allowed to do that, but now I don't care, because it's like, well, no, this is a story. It's not about hitting 50,000 words fresh anymore. It's about using that month to motivate me to finish the story and tie it together. So yeah, I'll take bits and pieces, maybe not all of what I've done, that I think fit into a story, and then I'll fill in the gaps. I'll turn it into a story. And then after that, I have a task set for myself to write or edit every day.
Oh.
And so every day.
This is after the month is over?
Yeah, this is all year round. I mean, during NaNoWriMo, that task is satisfied by doing NaNoWriMo.
Okay.
But the rest of the year, I generally will take one of the NaNoWriMo stories and I will go through and I'll edit it. And I'll rewrite, rephrase, look for gaps, and I usually go through two or three times, start to finish, of a book like that before I'll hand it over to an editor.
So I was going to ask you if you use a real editor.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been lucky enough to know a couple of people who are good editors. And so I'll hand it over to an editor. Then she'll go through and she'll tear it apart and find all the comma mistakes that I didn't notice, because I blind to commas and weaknesses in the plot that I didn't notice. And then I'll take that back and then I'll go through and I'll accept changes, or I'll dispute things like, no, I think you're wrong about that. And we'll go back and forth, and then we'll get a final version. And then that's what I put out.
So I can deal with somebody editing my work. Steve and I actually get into this because he likes to edit my blog posts. And I really, really hate it when he edits my blog posts. I would like somebody to find typos and maybe make suggestions that perhaps there was a better way to say something. But I hate every minute of that.
I went to journalism school. That was burned out of me very early on.
Okay.
The city editor of the Milwaukee Journal was my intro to journalism teacher. And he would just tear everything apart. And yeah, those first few times I was like, no, but, and then I eventually learned like, oh, you know what you do? You take the things that you agree with. You admit the things that, you know, you were wrong about. And then you fight for the things that you really think are important that shouldn't be changed. And there, you'll always have all three. And every editing experience I've ever had, I've always had all three. There's the things I'm like, oh yeah, I can't believe I missed that. There's the things that I'm like, oh, she's right. I don't want to admit it, but she's right. And then there are things where I'm like, no, you know what? I really do think that we should leave this character saying it this way or whatever.
Interesting. I don't know if I could do that. Maybe I could get used to it after a while.
Yeah. I mean, it's a confidence in your editor and yourself that you know that they don't mean anything by it.
Sure.
And you have, as the writer, you have the right to not accept any of their edits.
Okay.
They are only trying to help you. And as soon as I get myself into that mind space, I realize, okay, even though I don't like this, is it actually making it better? And sometimes it is, and sometimes it isn't.
Okay. Now, do you use friends for that? Or are these people is their job? Because I'm not sure I could stay friends. I might be able to do it, but I don't think I could stay friends.
Most recently, I've used a longtime friend who that is her job.
Oh, okay.
So it's both.
Okay. Well, that was probably one of the things I was curious the most about how you can stand that. That's an interesting piece of it. How do you make time for writing a book? Because I probably should have mentioned up front, Tom is the host of the Daily Tech News Show and so co-host of Sword and Laser, and you're on the morning stream with Scott Johnson. Is that all of the podcasts, or are there more?
Oh, Sword and Laser, Current Geek, FSL Tonight. Maybe someday it's a thing and Autopilot will come back, but yeah, East meets West.
So that's a lot of stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's
and you like to cook, and you've got dogs to play with, and a wife. And
it's TDMA. It's time division multiplex. So I have that task that says write and edit every day. So even on a day where I'm really full up, I still try to at least look at a paragraph. Okay. And then other days I'll have more time, and I'll get in and I'll do more.
Okay.
And then during National Novel Writing Month, I'm spending at least an hour a day, probably writing those 1,600 words. But yeah, I'm sectioned off.
It's time management. Just
a little bit every day. And eventually it happens. Yeah.
They say that's the way to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So if somebody wanted to check out your books, even though you've done a really good job of trying to convince them that they shouldn't, and these are terrible books,
I disagree. If you heed any of the warnings, head to tommerrittbooks.com. It's two M's. I guess it is two M's. TOMM. Two R's, two T's. And you should know that they are basically listed. Each book is listed based on delivery mechanisms. So if you're like, I don't know if I want to spend any money on you, Merritt, you can get a free PDF hosted off archive.org of almost every book. I think there's one book that I did with someone else that I didn't get their permission to do that, so I didn't. But I don't think I asked them. I think I just assumed. In all the other cases, there's a free version on PDF. But if you'd like it on your Kindle, you can pay for it to be delivered on Kindle, and there's print versions and all of that.
So you've tried to convince them that they're not very good, and please don't pay me for it.
Yeah.
So you're not in the marketing arm of this effort.
Right. No, and that's the important thing to remember about self-publishing. And I'm a horrible example, which is like, if you want to be successful, if you want to make it your job, you have to do all of the marketing and promotion.
The hustle, and, right.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to do all that yourself.
So you do it purely because you love it.
Yeah, I just enjoy doing it.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. And they can also find you at dailytechnewsshow.com.
That's right. You can find Allison on there sometimes too.
That does happen. And find you on Twitter at, you spell it.
It's Ace Detect, ACEDTECT. It's a long story. If you go to Tom Merritt on Twitter, you can learn how to spell Ace Detect. I have both counts.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed episode 408 of Chit Chat Across the Pond. This is an unsponsored show, so if you like what you hear, you can help support the show by using the Amazon affiliate link over on podfeet.com. You can also put up a review in iTunes and tell your friends about the podcast. I love feedback, so please do write to me at allison@podfeet.com and join in the conversation with other listeners in our Google Plus community at podfeet.com/Google Plus. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.